This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, which means the week in review, and let's talk taxes.
We're going to cut taxes for the middle class, make the tax code simpler and more fair for everyday Americans, and we are going to bring back the jobs and wealth that have left our country.
What the Republicans are putting it, they should never call it reform. It's not tax reform. It's tax cuts for the wealthiest 1% in our country.
The choice before us is really clear. We can succumb to the talking heads on TV and the special interests who want to maintain the status quo, or we can work together to seize this moment and do what the American people sent us here to do.
So what the plan does is the top rate on the wealthiest comes down and the bottom rate on working class families goes up. What kind of plan is this?
Let's answer that question with our Week in Review panel this week. Joining us is John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and a senior analyst for WBUR. It's good to see you, John.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. It's good to see you as well, Jim.
Good to be with you.
Okay. I'm going to start with you, Jim, because I said your name last. That's my thoughtful way of approaching this. What's your take on the framework that the Trump administration released for its idea of overhauling the tax code?
So three big takeaways, I think. One is I do think we should do something about the corporate tax rate. We do have the third highest rate in the world. We're up there with Chad in the United Arab Emirates.
They're proposing a cut of 15% down to 20%.
That's right. Yeah. And look, I think if you look at Ireland and Germany, they're in the 15% range. And I think we should aim to do something like that. I think at the same time, what you want to do is clear out all the barnacles that have been placed there by lobbyists who've gotten their favored tax breaks. Mm-hmm. You want to clear that out and lower the rate overall. I think that makes a lot of sense. It gets really complicated really fast when you talk about corporate tax rate, because there isn't just one. There's one for C corporations. That's what we think of when we think of a corporation, but also LLCs and, you know, subchapter S. And, you know, some of these are pitched as small businesses. Usually we say the pass-through structures like LLCs and subchapter S corporations are small businesses, but we have to remember that many of them are not. Think of your large law firms that are largely structured that way.
I read somewhere that 95% of American businesses are pass-throughs of some form or another.
I think it's 95% of the corporate tax revenue.
Comes from the pass-throughs.
That's right.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Interesting. All right. So, John, your thought.
Well, first of all, I mean, Donald Trump is like Groucho Marx in Duck Soup. You know, he's saying, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? You know, he sits there and he says, this is not going to benefit me. The most conservative estimate I've seen is he would save $1.1 billion in taxes with this plan. The other one, you know, talk about the pass-through entities. You know, 85% of small businesses already pay a tax of 25% or less. So this is really geared toward the bigger money people. So, the smaller people are the ones who aren't going to see any change. They're going to be in pretty much the same situation.
Yeah.
So and Donald Trump, by the way, has a pass-through entity. Mm-hmm. You know, his business, it would qualify for that.
Well, I just want to hear from some folks around Massachusetts. I'll quote Governor Baker, because just yesterday he was looking at the possible elimination of the state and local tax deduction. And he said, rightly, that would be a huge issue in Massachusetts. And it's a perfect example, the governor says, of the sort of thing that ought to be vetted, because there are going to be plenty of people, including me, who are going to think it's a bad idea. So to that point that the governor is making, Jim, I mean, the devil is in the details here, and Congress is going to hash out those details. And when you talk about closing any of these, limiting any of these deductions, there's a special interest behind every single one of them. So it makes me think that this is a long, hard slog ahead of us.
I think the game hasn't even started, right? That was just the announcement there's going to be a game, and they haven't even started on this. I would say that it is a huge deal for Massachusetts, New York, California, if state deductibility is taken out. And if you think about it in terms of, you know, there's a potential millionaire's tax that's going to be on the ballot next year. If you're a top earner, you're going to get the 4%, then you're going to get the tax deductibility out of it. That's a huge, huge hit all of a sudden for someone who's in Massachusetts. I would also say there's lots of details here around the various tax deductions and credits that have been in place before. Mm. If you think about the desire to get rid of carve-outs for, let's say, even mortgage write-offs, That would be a huge thing in Massachusetts, in large part because
everything's so expensive here. People have giant mortgages.
Giant mortgages.
Yeah. You know, the Tax Policy Center just this afternoon came out with its preliminary analysis, John, and they find that that the plan would reduce federal revenue by $2.4 trillion over 10 years. And so what that makes me wonder is there is this, you know, the idea that closing the loopholes would increase some of the revenue that's lost with these tax cuts. But where are the deficit hawks all of a sudden?
They're not in the GOP, apparently, because, you know, most of them are perfectly willing to do this. I mean, what's set up is that now they have until November 13th to draft tax bills that costs no more than $1.5 trillion in lost revenues. So if you have an estimate of $2.6 trillion, then all of a sudden you're into a really serious gap here. And I also wanted to point out that the tax cuts don't come along that often. But the 1986 tax cut under Ronald Reagan and the 2001 under George W. Bush were bipartisan tax cuts. And the only way this thing is going to get through, I think, is for it to go to some kind of bipartisan agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to hear from a couple of voices here in Massachusetts with differing views on this. First, Chris Geerin with the Associated Industries of Massachusetts. They say the proposal to reduce the corporate tax rate is going to be great because it'll give businesses more money to invest back into the economy.
All of those savings then get plowed back into the business. So these companies buy new machinery, they buy new computer systems, they put additions on their plants, they hire new people.
So that's the Associated Industries of Massachusetts. Congressman Michael Capuano, though, is looking at another proposal within the framework, and that's the repeal of the estate tax. He does not like it.
The repeal of the estate tax guarantees that wealth will stay in the hands of generation after generation after generation of children who happen to be born to wealthy parents.
And that's the federal estate tax, we should say, which kicks in at above $5 million for individuals. So last quick question about taxes for both of you, and it's something keying off what you were saying, John. Our tax code is enormous. It's unwieldy. It's complicated. Those people who can will game it. And it is ripe for some kind of overhaul and reform. But my question is, to your point of bipartisan, that we need bipartisan agreement, given the nature of politics today, will that ever be possible? Jim?
No.
Thank you for thinking about it for one second.
The short answer.
But I think the longer answer is that the problem with John raised a really interesting question. He said Reagan versus Bush. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Bush tax cuts weren't as bipartisan as the Reagan ones were. And it's an important point because the Reagan tax cuts actually had a much bigger impact on investment and on job creation and on the economy. And it's largely because they weren't temporary. If we have to go through a reconciliation process, we only get 50 plus one votes, then it has to be revenue neutral and to a certain degree. And that means that these are temporary tax cuts. Most investment decisions that have huge impact are in a longer trajectory.
Yeah.
So a tax reform which has bipartisan support that allows things to be done over a 25-year window, it's much better for job creation.
Mm. John?
The other problem is people are living in parallel information universes here.
Yeah.
And there's very little intersection between the two narratives that are coming out. So there's this movement for repatriation. They say, you know, bring overseas profits back into America, lower the tax so that it's not as painful. That'll be a windfall for the economy. In the past, that's been a windfall for stockholders. And stockholders don't pour it back into the economy. They don't go out and buy more groceries. They make more investments. So, you know, you look at these things and the effects of them are being depicted as two completely opposite things. Mm-hmm. And until there can be some kind of agreement on basic facts, you know, you add in the politics that are involved. I just don't see how this gets worked out.
Yeah. You know, and again, the Tax Policy Center from the Urban Institute in Brookings, they find that basically 50% of the benefit of the tax cuts here, as in the framework, as far as we know so far, is probably going to go to the top 1%. But I will also spare both of you my deep and profound desire to talk about the idea of the immediate write-off of capital investment depreciation.
What about the alternative minimum tax?
The AMT?
We didn't even get to that.
I'm gonna spare you all, and let's move on to the local municipal elections that we had this week. Cities and towns across Massachusetts headed to the polls on Tuesday. In Boston, a whopping 14% of people bothered to vote. Hooray for democracy. In the preliminary for the Boston mayoral race, Mayor Walsh took 63% of that 14%. City Councilor Tito Jackson took 29%. And Mayor Walsh, in fact, took Tito Jackson's district. And here is the mayor on his record speaking to Morning Edition.
We've set numbers for record affordable housing being built in the city of Boston. We've set records for housing being built in the city of Boston. We've improved our schools. Our quality of life's better. Our public safety's, we're working with community policing and doing better community policing than most places in the country. So I think a lot of people like the way Boston's going.
Councilor Tito Jackson begs to differ, and here he is.
He will not get to run away from his record this go-round. A record of the Olympics, a record of IndyCar, a record of corporate giveaways. As mayor of the city of Boston, I will be working on uplifting all people, closing the income inequality gap, and dealing with the displacement that is happening all over the city of Boston.
So, Jim, let me start with you. I mean, is the race between now and November for the mayor of the city of Boston going to be a tale of two Bostons? That's what it sounds like to me.
It'll be a tale of two Bostons, but frankly, I think on this one, I disagree with the mayor on a number of things, but I think he's done a good job. And I think the problem with what Tito has said, and I appreciate the fact that he's running, I think we should have competitive race. I think the city's gotten way too used to having the same mayor for so long so they don't come out and vote. All that said, he cites the Olympics and IndyCar racing. Those two things didn't happen,
mm-hmm.
right? And instead, I think the mayor can say, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. Yeah, people have made mistakes. Okay. I think it's a tough thing for Tito to run on, honestly.
John?
Well, you know, Boston mayoral races are like Groundhog Day. You know, it's always 2-1 for the incumbent. I mean, that's how it works out all the time. There have been 4 mayors in Boston over the last 50 years. It's virtually impossible, unless you're in jail, as James Michael Curley was, yeah. It's virtually impossible to unseat an incumbent. And, you know, one of the interesting things about Tito Jackson is one of the things he's emphasizing is the wealth disparity in Boston. And example A is Marty Walsh versus Tito Jackson. Marty Walsh has $4 million. Tito Jackson has $100,000 in his war chest. So I think that that's going to be a significant problem as well. And just one last thing. Tito Jackson on election night, on Tuesday night, gets up and says, what was proven today is that people won over power. And I just think that's bizarro world. I mean, how can you possibly say that when you've just been beaten that badly at the polls? So I agree that it's good for competition. I agree that it's good to have a person of color running for mayor for the first time in, what, 30-something years?
Yep.
But I just think that the balance of power in Boston is such that it's virtually impossible to beat the mayor and to not get run out of town afterwards the way Sam Yun did.
Oh gosh, that's right. Even after that was the era of unity that
exactly.
didn't quite work
yeah.
out. Oh, poor Sam Yun. He was a good guy. No, I my only thought for now, because we're going to keep covering this, the race vigorously between now and November, is, and this is my just heartfelt appeal to Bostonians. I know it's a preliminary. I know it's September. I know you probably think you have better things to do. And I also know it's a Tuesday, not a weekend. That's my other gripe about how we vote in the United States. But 14%? Like, come on. I don't think we can actually draw any conclusion for how much support Walsh has versus how much support Jackson has. Like, next time, more folks, just get out and vote so we can actually talk about what Bostonians are really saying when they're at the ballot box in the preliminaries.
The only thing you conclude is that 9 out of 10 Boston residents don't care who's their mayor, which is really remarkable.
Yeah. We had some precincts with, like, a 1% turnout. I'm looking at Allison Bruzek. She went and voted, though. She did her job. She's my producer. Through, had a low turnout precinct. All right, so let's move on to one more thing from this week, and that has to do with President Trump and the NFL and the continuing controversy that he has stirred when objecting to players who take a knee at the national anthem. Last night at Lambeau Field in Wisconsin, the Packers and the Bears locked arms. The Packers and the Bears locked arms on the sidelines during the national anthem. Here's Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers speaking to CBS Sports earlier this week.
It's never been about the military or our men and women in uniform. like I said after the game, we'd love and support them. This is about equality. This is about unity and love and growing together as a society and starting a conversation around something that may be a little uncomfortable for people.
And, of course, all this began when Colin Kaepernick, a long while ago, began to take a knee during the national anthem to protest police brutality against unarmed Black folks in this country. Now, on Monday, we spoke to Matt Light. He is a 3-time Super Bowl champion, former New England Patriot. He does not like folks taking a knee, and here's what he said.
I stress to you that if the President of the United States says that standing and saluting the flag is important to show respect to the men and women who serve this country and what we stand for, if you want to turn that into a racist remark, I think you're out of your mind, and I think you're completely off base.
John?
Matt Light has it exactly backwards. This is not about the military. It was about racial equality. It's now about Donald Trump. And this is another example of Donald Trump's uncanny ability to make everything about himself. And unfortunately, what Colin Kaepernick started is probably never going to get finished because this has been sidetracked in a way
completely.
People are not looking at the issues that are important here. This has never been about the military. The owners, I just have to say one thing about the owners. The owners who have blackballed Colin Kaepernick, you know, to be going out there standing in solidarity with their players is the height of hypocrisy. And I'll just single out Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys, who had it both ways. He went out and knelt with the team before
for 5
the
seconds,
anthem,
right.
And then they stood up and locked arms during the anthem. I mean, that's just cowardice on a massive level.
Jim?
Look, I think this is already controversial, what you said when Colin Kaepernick did it, when he started this, right? So I think Trump has an incidental, unfortunately, large impact on this because he's basically poured gasoline on a fire. But I think I actually have a very positive view of this stuff. I mean, I don't really care much about football. Everybody knows me. I don't really care about sports. But, you know, we learned something from this. One is a lot of friends of mine actually have learned that the federal government pays the NFL to boost patriotism. I think we've all learned that people have been standing for the anthem probably since after World War II. Mm-hmm. We've learned again something we knew, which is that Americans are very good at twisting facts to suit their narrative. I think we've also gone back and realized this is truly a free speech issue.
Yeah.
But we've also realized that there are curbs on free speech when you work for somebody. And when I see people who actually lock arms together, and that's they've come up with some sort of compromise, whether you like it or not, it's a step forward where people actually recognize, as I think Aaron Rodgers did, this is a thing this is a real issue, and we should come together, and we should actually try to work through it. And I think give it a couple of weeks, we'll get to some place that's a little bit better than where we were.
You know what I would add to that? I think I've been trying to read, through social media as much of what various members of the military themselves feel. Because, I mean, it's not monolithic. There are many folks who agree with the president, but there are also many folks who say, do not politicize our service for any reason whatsoever, right? Some people say we fought for people to have the right to for free speech. But regardless of that, I am continuously... how am I going to say this? I'm somewhat taken aback by our country's on multiple sides willingness to politicize the military for whatever point of view you want, and I feel like that's on full display here too.
That's part of it. I mean, that's been dragged into it. And again, you know, that was not part of what Colin Kaepernick was doing.
Right. We shouldn't forget what the primary issue was.
It was about racial inequality. It was about racial justice. It was about police brutality against Black people. That's what Colin Kaepernick was about. Yeah. You know, it's instructive to look at the contrast between the NBA and the NFL. There was an interesting column in the Daily News today. You know, the NBA has said to its players, you have a social consciousness, you have a voice, go out and use it. And the NFL is saying, basically, and a lot of politicians are saying, you can have a voice, but you can't have it as a football player. You can have it as a private individual. So I think the NFL, the way they're trying to corral this is very different from the NBA, which is basically saying, you know, we understand this is part of your role. Be responsible, but be socially conscious
as well.
So, but
why? What's different about the NFL? What do you think is different about it?
Because at least according to this column, the NBA is about players. You think about the NBA logo, it's a player. It's, you know, it's Jerry West. You think about the NFL logo, it's a shield.
Yeah, oh,
it's
the shield.
League.
Yeah.
So the league is the thing that's most important. The league is the thing that needs to be protected. The NBA is much more player-oriented than the NFL is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I just think that football is a far more sort of military-style game, where you have people calling shots from the side and their head full. You know, it's much more structured, whereas the NBA is much more individualistic as a game anyways. Mm. So I think that's just seeped into the culture.
I'm hearing a lot of Celtics fans not being happy with what you just said, so let's move on while we can.
I played basketball, so I kind of know.
Okay, good.
I would steal the ball and do whatever I wanted.
And you told me that. Why do you say you know nothing about sports, Jim? Well, we have enough time for our hubbubs this week, and those are the stories that didn't make it above the fold or the top of the newscast. And Jim, you're up. You're first at bat with your hubbub.
My hubbub, I'm on deck, right?
My hubbub is about the BU and WBUR. It's not the wonderful gift that Rajan Kilachan gave to create the Integrated Life Science Engineering Center, but it's about Nadine and Diana, who run the campus trolley at BU. In the mid-1980s, when I attended, campus trolley was one of the only places you could actually get something good to eat. The best falafel sandwiches around. It fit my budget, reminding my mother's cooking. A letter that's taped to the trolley, same old trolley, says they will no longer be open for business. It says, the city of Boston has lots of laws and requirements. We need to build an in-ground plumbing system or build wheels for the trolley and move it every day. It is impossible for us to do this at this time. We would like to thank you for your business and support all these years. My husband and I are heartbroken. We miss you and love you. Nadine and Diana are why I support free markets. They are great people, and they should be able to make a living.
Absolutely. The trolley has been there forever. Ugh. Okay, well, I have to say I did not even know, and they're just down the road from us here at BUR.
Right.
Oh, Jim, a good but that's a heartbreaking hubbub. John, yours.
Well, I smell a GoFundMe campaign here. You know, I think that would be appropriate. My hubbub is exhibit umpteen of why it's good to live in a two-daily town. In the Boston Globe today on page B2, there is an AP paragraph that says, school says librarian rejected book on her own. A Cambridge school librarian rejected a donation of 10 Dr. Seuss books from the First Lady, Melania Trump, to commemorate National Read a Book Day. She wrote an open letter on a blog and said, you know, we have enough resources, and Dr. Seuss is a bit of a cliche. So that was one paragraph on page two. In the Boston Herald, it was two full pages, and it included this sentence from the librarian's letter. Dr. Seuss's illustrations are steeped in racist propaganda, caricatures, and harmful stereotypes. And she talks about the racist mockery in his art.
Absolutely, yeah.
Nephew Seuss has vehemently challenged that. And basically, the Herald has also challenged that. So good to live in a two-daily town.
Absolutely.
That's all I have to say.
I'm on the Herald side. That's a story.
Yep, absolutely.
So, well, my hubbub, I'm just going to quickly do it because I do want to say that this week we also found out that David Henenberry, the man who found Jahar Tsarnaev in his boat in Watertown, passed away just a couple of days ago. Everyone remembers. I mean, we remember hearing his 911 call when he discovered Jahar Tsarnaev. And just a real key figure that history and the news visited his house even though he didn't want it, and he passed away. So just a shout-out and our thoughts with the Henenberry family. And that's it for our Week in Review. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.